I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about something that is really at the heart of this podcast of The American Idea, and that is civic education. It's near and dear to the heart and mind of the Ashbrook Center. It's central to our mission, and we are privileged today to be talking about this important issue with someone who I consider one of the leading thinkers and the leading doers of civic education in the country, Professor Bill McLay. He is professor of history at Hillsdale College in Michigan, where he holds the Victor Davis Hanson Chair of Classical History and Western Civilization. I also have to tell our folks he is, and we're delighted to have him as a member of the Ashbrook National Advisory Board on Civic Education, where he's rendered wonderful service to us. Many of you listeners know him from his scholarly work, which ranges across the discipline of history and historiography, but of course, most recently, his wonderful book, Land of Hope, which Bill was just telling me they're in the process of a second edition, expanded, improved, revised, taking a lot of your time, but no doubt a labor of love that's definitely worth it for the country. Bill, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Well, thank you for that and for that reminder that all this trouble is for something larger than myself. That's a good thing to be reminded of.
We're talking about better civics for a better republic. And that sounds like a very academic and even kind of intellectual title and way of thinking. But you've actually written that civic education is as much a matter of the heart as it is of the head. What do you mean by that?
Well, we think of civics, people my age, we still had a subject in school called civics. I don't know that that's the case in most public schools. I went to public school today, or if it is civics, it's crammed in with something else, driver's ed or personal hygiene. I don't know, but it's treated very much as a secondary subject. And to the extent that it's taught, we think of it as a sort of how-to manual. That is, to be a citizen, because civic education has to do with citizenship. To be a citizen, you have to know how to vote, how the voting process works, how a bill becomes a law, maybe how the three branches of the federal government are organized, how the federal system works with the states and the federal government and the whole system, which is actually a very complicated system, works. And maybe even a little bit about why it's constructed the way it is, maybe, but often just this is the way it is. And that's fine to a point, but that isn't, as you implied in your question, I don't believe that's more than scratching the surface of what civics is about, because civics involves an understanding of the relationship of the citizen to the country of which he or she is a part, and that it is, by virtue of that, as you said, a matter not just of the head, but of the heart, of a feeling or of connection to the past, to those who have come before us, who have helped to make this polity that we live in, the freedoms we enjoy, what they are. And I've just simply respect for our forebears, that's a part of civic education, to educate us, to have the kind of reverence for that past that is what's required for us to call forth from citizens great deeds, sacrificial deeds. That's one of the things we have to do as citizens. We can't just be constantly concerned with our own interests, our own betterment. To be a good citizen is to see our own well-being as bound up in the well-being of the polity towards which we have a responsibility. And that's particularly true in a Republican form of government, which is we have a form of government that is self-government. We govern ourselves. We don't we don't have a king. We don't have a monarch. We don't have a dictator. Thank goodness. We rule ourselves through this complicated mechanism that's described in the Constitution, or it's laid out in the Constitution. And good citizenship involves knowing why that structure evolved in the way that it did and what it means for us, what it provides for us. Yes, I think the cultivation of a certain kind of love is a part of that. It's not the sum total of it either. We don't want people to be this sort of mindlessly love their country without having any idea why the country is lovable or deserves their love.
You have talked about that question or that difficulty of you want to cultivate love, but I think in some place you've written, you called it a tough-minded love.
What do you mean by that? We have to face, we have to face the fact that our past, like all pasts, of all individuals, with the possible exception of one, a past that's full of sinful, misbegotten, wrongheaded behavior. We've made mistakes. We've committed errors of commission and omission. Those are part of our past. We have to face that. When I wrote Land of Hope, that was a constant element in it that I wanted to write a book that had what I think American history deserves, an affirmative view. Friend of mine who I actually got to know, a lawyer in New York, I had a conversation with him before, as I was writing Land of Hope. And he said, look, I think that any young person who grows up believing that his or her regime, the regime under which they're living, is unjust, is bad, has not just imperfect education, they have a hole in their souls, that it's really damaging to their souls to be taught that the regime is sort of irredeemably bad. So I took that to heart. I realized he's absolutely right, and that an education that didn't try to instill a right relationship to the past was damaging. But you can't do that by sugarcoating everything that's happened. You can't, all of the ways in which we have fallen short. I think all that has to be acknowledged. The real question is not whether you've acknowledged our misbegotten deeds, our misconceptions, our blatant hypocrisies and injustices, but do we have a picture of the American past that is rightly ordered? Do we have the proper perspective on it? Because if you, we all go through this when we grow up, and we discover our parents are not perfect, some of us earlier than others. Mine weren't very imperfect, but they were. And you have this great feeling, my whole world is collapsing. And there are a bunch of hypocrites. The teenagers are the world champions at the denouncing of hypocrisy.
Yes, I have teenage children.
yes. And I remember being that way myself. And I think it's hopefully something you grow out of when you realize that, God works with flawed people because those are the only ones available. But you have to, in the end, put it all in perspective. Yes, my father was not perfect. He had a terrible temper, for example. I mean, true in my case, but he also had a capacity for asking and giving forgiveness, which to my mind more than compensated for his occasional outbursts, usually justified of anger. So it's a matter of perspective. I really struggled with that, with telling the bad, but putting it in perspective, putting it in the proper larger context.
Well, so I was just going to say, your book suggests that the larger narrative is, or the larger ordering, as you said, is maybe the word hope.
Yes. Yes. I that title, I wanted to have that in the title, because one of the things I think, if you try to describe America, and here I prefer to use the term America rather than the United States, because it's just more full of this elusive emotion. But if you give an account of America that leaves out the dimension of hope, you're not really talking about America. You may be, like Aristotle said, you could describe man as a featherless biped, but that doesn't really tell you what man is.
Right.
America is a country that is in its deepest aspirational. You could say that, with the exception of those who were brought over here in bondage, that Americans are, the American population is made up of people who saw the possibility of a better life and were willing to cross oceans and come overland in order to achieve that betterment. And that's one of the several meanings of Land of Hope. It's a land that's dedicated to the proposition that no one should be condemned to live out their lives strictly under the conditions into which they were born, so that the occupation of their fathers, of their family, of the geographical location, that all of the things that in the old world were taken as givens. For Americans are not, we're adventurous, we're aspirational. That word, it seems the best to me. We're aspirational, we aspire, and we aspire for our children to be better than we were. If you go to a naturalization ceremony, people who are foreigners who come to the United States legally, I might add, and become citizens through the specified process of naturalization, you've never seen, it's so moving. It's so, I always think that it would be a great thing if every civics class could include a visit to a naturalization ceremony, because immigration is very much, and of course it's a very controversial concept right now, because there's so much, we're overloaded with immigrants, and they're not coming legally. But take that away. Immigration is the idea that you can come across an ocean from one place to a place where you have the opportunity to start anew. That's part of the dream of America. That's part of the lure of America. And I think you can't tell the story without including that. So that's another aspect of the Land of Hope.
That almost reminds me of Abraham Lincoln's fragment on the Constitution, where he talks about the apple of gold, the Declaration of Independence, sort of the principle of liberty to all, which he explicitly says gives hope to all.
Yeah. Yeah.
Clears the path for all.
Yes. And he, you know, when he uses the phrase in one of his speeches, America's the last best hope of mankind, which some people have criticized as being kind of overdoing it, sentimental. Well, no, what he was really talking about, it was, so Lincoln was really referring to America as the last best hope of mankind, that a large, a continental republic founded on, as he said in the Gettysburg Address, the proposition that all men are created equal, could survive. And so that and language follows on into the Gettysburg Address, of course.
Yeah. So let me ask you something. Another point that you've made, besides this importance of love and hope in thinking about civics, is You've talked about the importance and written yourself in a way that makes it clear you can't do civics disentangled, disembodied, decontextualized from history. And that if you study history, you need to study it civically. So that civics and history, which are often separate subjects in a high school or separate classes in college, your argument has been, no, that's incorrect. They really need to be studied together. Why do you believe that?
Yeah. Yes, especially on the high school level and to some extent in colleges and universities too. Well, you know, in my field, I'm a trained historian. I have a PhD from Johns Hopkins and all of that. And you know, the people who founded Hopkins and to some extent the people who are there now really believe that history should be understood as a kind of science. And, you know, the thing about a science is that it seeks truth irrespective of the context, nationality, you know, where someone is embedded or placed. The laws of physics are the laws of physics. Well, history is not like that, because history, especially a history of one's nation, a patriotic history, if I may put it that way, is about the things that are one's own. It's a coming to know, better know oneself by studying the past. And so you can't look at it as something that in which you have no personal stake. That's simply a category error to do that. The ethos of professional history writing, which I've been imbued with, and you know, the notion of careful use of evidence and seeking for objectivity and that sort of thing, is an important part. We don't want to tell lies about our past, as I think I've already said, you know, that we don't want to do that. But at the same time, there's a larger purpose that is the completion of our education as citizens. And our education as citizens means that we know how deeply everything that we are and that we have is indebted to those who came before us, those who established institutions, maybe even those who established flawed institutions, but still we are indebted to those who came before us for sort of setting the table for the tasks that face us today. So it's civics is not, to go back to where we began, civics is not a matter of learning like seven principles that exist irrespective of time and place and situation and context.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm thinking about, so if you're a teacher and you're approaching this, whether you're in high school or whether you yourself are teaching in college, a person said, let's try and understand, for example, presidential powers and war powers. You're saying, look, don't just do that abstractly.
Yes.
Look at a historical moment like, for example, Franklin Roosevelt in World War II or Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War. Immerse yourself historically into that moment.
To
truly deeply understand the thing you're talking about.
Absolutely. Another good example would be how we think about figures like Thomas Jefferson, figures from the founding. Thomas Jefferson, one of the many founders who owned slaves. What was distinctive about Jefferson, what gets people's ire up against him, is that he saw slavery as an evil. He wrote about it. He saw it as something that degraded both the slaveholder and the slave, the enslaved person. What burns people about him in this respect is that he didn't act on it. He didn't manumit his slaves as he could have. And so he's a flawed man. But, you know, I've always taken heart from some words of John Lewis, the late John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia, who was also a leader of the civil rights movement in its heyday in the 1960s. Lewis, I'll have to paraphrase, I don't have the quote in my head, but he said, we knew about Jefferson. We knew about his being a slaveholder. We knew about all his failings. But what mattered to us were his words in the Declaration. and that they ring down through history. And then he says that those words were like a fountain that's ever flowing that we could drink from. And I think that's, you know, you said it, John, the notion that imperfect people can nevertheless be heroes is something we need to recover. I think this is sort of the theme of our whole conversation. It's that our history is made up of people that, like us, are imperfect. We should wish to treat the past and the figures of the past the way we hope that we could be treated in the future.
So do you think that there, I was just going to say, in your experience now, working on Land of Hope, teaching across the country, of course, teaching at your college, is there a hunger for this kind of civic education?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I didn't want to write Land of Hope. People came to me wanting me to do it, and I didn't want to do it because, well, there's all sorts of reasons, including a very selfish reason that in my line of work, to write a textbook is not an act that wins you much favor in your professional community. And to write one with a favorable view of American history, but I knew if I took it on, that's what I would have to do, because that's what I would want to do. That's what I would, it wasn't my assignment. It was the honest telling of history as a civic activity, as an act of civic education. I expected it would be a minor success, would be, you know, maybe excoriated by a few of my history colleagues who would say, "Oh, horrors, Maclay has written a textbook," but that it wouldn't attract much attention. And I was I thought realistic about that. I didn't know. I think we've sold, I don't know exactly, so I may be, this number may be wrong on the low side or the high side, but I think we sold about 200,000 copies at this point. Astounding to me. I did not expect it. When the book was published, I did an interview with the Wall Street Journal, and the next week, the book shot up to number 8 on Amazon of all books. Those sales were not coming from students. Those sales were coming from people my age, your age, adults who are longing for a kind of honest but affirmative retelling of the American past that they know in their bones is the truth, but they're not getting that from the Guild of Professional Historians, who have their own fixation on being critical, relentlessly critical, and on race and gender and all these other identity politics sorts of things. I was shocked by that, but it's an indication of exactly what you asked me about, is there is a hunger. It's more than I underestimated the extent of it. It is really amazing. And I think it's because Americans, they don't want a sickly sweet account of the country being perfect that they know is not true, that they know they can't believe in. What they want is an account that's honest. And if I could use a word that's been much abused lately, inclusive, that groups like racial minorities who have been excluded or have been, again, abused the word, marginalized in accounts of American past, have a place not just on the margins, but in the whole picture of a unified people that are involved in a great story.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Well, it is something that we've seen, our work at Ashbrook with students and with teachers across the country, especially elementary, middle, and high school teachers, looking for that kind of civic education and wanting to provide that kind of civic education to their students. We've seen that same kind of hunger. And I was going to follow up on that thought of yours by asking you, because you've also written about the importance, the civic importance of the social importance, the importance for the polity of teachers, of history and civics and government and social studies teachers. And the suggestion I think you've made is that there, lots of people say teachers are underpaid, but your suggestion is they are civically undervalued. Help us understand why you think teachers and history and civics teachers are so important.
Well, we have to have a common story. That doesn't mean we all have to sort of sign on the dotted line to say that as an American, I believe X, Y, and Z. No, and a story, you can have a common story in which people don't agree about many details. Is still a common story. And we have to have this commonality. If we lose our shared sense of the past, we really lose our country. It's that simple. So the people who are doing their part to instill in the young a sense of that story and of it being their story, a story that they can and should and will appropriate, make their own. Those people deserve a lot better than they're getting. They even just the reputation of civic teachers as people who are primarily football coaches or that are really doing this sort of add-on thing. I ought to be central. Civics is properly understood. Civics is more important, more essential than almost any other subject. I mean, learning how to read is important, learning basic numeracy, mathematics, but civic education should be right up there with those kinds of fundamentals. Because if we want to have a Republican form of government, we want to continue as the Constitution dictates. A Republican means self-ruling. That means that we participate as citizens in the work of governing. So we don't turn it over to experts. We don't turn it over to people who are just strong arms. We are involved. We should be. And for the civic health, we must be involved. So, I'm all for civics, being teachers of civics, being honored. And if they let me into the room where the green eyeshade guys are figuring out the budgets, I'll say, up those civic teachers, up their salaries. So, give them the tools they need and the support they need. Because teachers, I've done a lot of work with teachers, as you have. And I think that many teachers, although they complain and justifiably about poor pay, the ones who are most needlessly and I think unfortunately disaffected, it doesn't have to do with that. They're not allowed to do their jobs. That's what it is. They're not respected in the work that they do. And they, everybody who goes into teaching has had someone tell them, you're not going to get rich doing this. You do know that. And generally they hear it. We hear it, professors don't get rich either. And I was a high school teacher once too. So and my wife was a high school teacher. So come from a family of teachers, we know this. But it's a privileged, it's a noble occupation. It's a privileged occupation in the sense that What you get to do is to enter into the lives and souls of young people and have a part in shaping them. Now, I think a lot of schools are like factories. They're really dismal places. They don't. The idea, oh, I'm here forming the souls of young people, that sounds ridiculous. Well, but there are a lot of schools where it's not a ridiculous thing. And a lot of teachers who really believe that, or they entered into the profession believing that. And let's do right by them. That idealism, if we could bottle it and sell it, it would save the country. So let's at least treat with a more than a modicum, a greater degree of respect those who give their lives and their spirit and give up things that might be more lucrative to do with their life, but less satisfying. Less satisfying. There is, when you with teaching is the most satisfying thing there is when it goes well. And I hope one of the things I hope to do, and I think you're about this business too, is to do what we can to encourage schools to be better environments for the soul-shaping activities that are really what education is about. Not the only thing. Knowledge acquisition is definitely, it has to be the core of it. But you're shaping the souls of the young, especially when it comes to how they feel about their country. What's their disposition? Is their disposition to make sacrifices on the behalf of the greater good of the whole? Or is it to just view the country and the government as their enemy? You know, there is also built into the American story a suspicion of government. That's part of our heritage too. Suspicion of power, concentrated power. That's why the Constitution looks the way it does. That's part of our heritage too. And that should be part of civic education. You know, you don't want to give the government too much control over your lives. You don't want to turn things over. That's not the Republican way. That's not the civic humanist tradition's way of dealing with.
Well, that is this. Yeah, this has been that's such an important reminder, and what a important affirmation of the kind of civic education we should be doing, and an affirmation of the value of those in the classroom who are helping carry it out. I know it's what you care about, Bill. I know it's what we at the Ashbrook Center care about so deeply. And want to thank you for taking the time for this really interesting, fascinating conversation on the importance and meaning of civic education.
Well, thank you. And I do want to say thank you for the privilege of having an association with the Ashbrook Center, which has been doing this stuff for a long time, even before. I mean, now that we are suddenly in an era where people recognize this, you don't feel like you're talking to the stone-faced deaf people anymore. But the Ashbrook Center has been doing this when it wasn't cool. And you've been keeping the faith and just digging in there and pounding away gently. And it's starting to work. It's starting to have an effect. I'm very optimistic about this continuing. It's not going to depend on the outcome of the next presidential election. It's going to depend on us. That's one of the things we need to recover, is a sense that it's all very well to pray that the election goes well and that the candidates that you believe are best for us are elected, but we have a job to do, and we have to do no matter who gets elected.
That's such a great reminder. Bill, thanks for taking the time to join us today on The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.